Hello and welcome to episode 432 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Be LSAT famous. You can share news and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. On Monday, December 11th at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Well, that's today, actually. Just realized that. I'm going to be doing a free class. So if you hear this, come join me. You can sign up at lsat.link/free. Even if you can't make the class, you can watch the recording by doing the same thing. Just create a Demon free account and then watch the video. What are we going to be doing? Logical reasoning. And this is an intermediate level class. So yeah, hope to see you there. We have the February 2024 registration deadline coming up. That's on December 26th, the day after Christmas. Anything to say there?
Yeah, it's just, as always, when the registration deadline arrives, you look at your practice test scores and you determine whether your practice test scores justify you taking that test. You shouldn't be signing up for tests first and then hoping that your practice test scores get you there. You should be getting there via regular timed practice. Take it seriously. Take the practice test seriously. Take your results, you know, not like obsess over them, but the test doesn't lie. You know, if you do a time test, it tells you where you're at. And so on December 26th, you can make the decision, okay, am I close enough to take it in February or not? Am I within striking distance or not?
Yeah.
And I think we agree that if you're not within 10 points, then you're just probably not within striking distance.
Yeah, easily. Yeah, 10 points.
That's a for sure no, right? Yeah. If you're at 0 point, like if you're happy with your practice test scores, if you look at your practice tests and you go, yeah, that would be the kind of number that would get me the right school at the right price, then we think you should register for a test for sure. If you're somewhere in between, you know, maybe you're 5 points away or something like that, then it's a little bit of a gray area. At that point, I think we kind of really don't care whether you sign up or not. But it's always fine to default to no. Don't waste $215. Don't waste one of your five attempts that the LSAC allows you in 5 years.
I agree. The wrinkle to all of that, of course, is starting in August of 2024, the logic games are going away. So if you're a very strong logic game test taker and you're not ready for February yet, you still may want to register and then decide to withdraw later if you don't get to the scores that you want to get to. But it's one of your last three options to take the test with games.
Right. Yeah. But the tests that are remaining to be registered for that have games on them is February, April, June of 2024. And at that point, the games are going away. So if that is your strength, then yeah, there's a one-time only incentive to accelerate the timeline a little bit to try to get those games on record.
Yeah. Pay money to keep the option open to take it in February. Yeah. Basically.
Go to lsat.link/dates if you want to see a full list of all of the scheduled tests and their registration deadlines.
Great. This first sentence under our word of the week is from me. I was reading about the volcano that erupted a little bit, I guess, in Indonesia last week. Did you hear about this?
I saw something that there was an eruption and a tsunami warning possible. So, yeah.
Okay. So the sentence is, Indonesia, the world's largest archipelago nation, is sprawled across the so-called Ring of Fire, where the meeting of tectonic plates catalyzes earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. Okay, archipelago, that is a word I've seen for a long time, but never crystallized in my mind exactly what it meant. So I looked it up. It's a group of islands. Now this sentence makes so much more sense to me. Indonesia is a archipelago nation. In other words, it's a nation made up of a group of islands. So Hawaii must be an archipelago state, I guess, right?
I think that's right.
Yeah. So anyways, that's my word of the week.
Archipelago. There you go. It's funny how, you know, I've seen that word a million times and I probably never really paid attention to exactly what it means. But
yeah,
just a group of islands. That's it. It's a simple word. And you can probably tell from context, but it's quite enriching to look words up. Just last night, I was looking up, I can't remember what I was talking about, but I was trying to refer to something as like kind of a mix.
Mm-hmm.
And I called it a succotash.
Succotash. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what succotash is?
Nope.
Well, it turns out that succotash is an example of, it's a kind of a mix, but it's not a mix. It's not like I didn't use that word correctly. Succotash is actually a corn dish. It's like corn and shelled beans and stuff mixed together, but it is like kind of a mix.
Yeah.
Then I also learned the word mélange.
Okay.
Which I guess is coming from French. M-E-L-A-N-G-E, mélange.
Okay.
And I think it's got the accent over the E, so that's why it's mélange.
Okay.
But mélange really does mean a mix. So that's actually probably the word that I should have used. Or I could have not been a douche and just said mix. But anyway.
Yeah, there are a lot of words, right, that you should know, but never use.
Yeah, like utilize, for example.
Yeah. Cool. Well, if you guys have a word of the week, some word that you looked up, let us know. Go to thinkingelsat.com and tell us. I'm curious what words you're starting to look up now that hopefully you're looking them up. This first email is from Anonymous. The subject is one less ABA law school. Okay, that's the American Bar Association accredited school.
Wow, Golden Gate University Law School, rest in peace. Except not really. I read into the news a little bit more, and you'll be excited to know, Ben, that Golden Gate University School of Law is going to stay open, and they are going to keep giving degrees. They're just not going to give JDs anymore. So they're going to be at the forefront of legal education, according to them, by giving other sorts of degrees, just not JDs.
What degrees are they giving?
Good question. I don't know. Somebody would have to dig into it, you know, more closely. I think that they do give bachelor's degrees. Like, I think Golden Gate is also an undergraduate university and it has several grad schools associated with it. And so I think you can go get like a bachelor's in criminal justice, would be my guess. I think you can also get like master's in legal studies.
Oh, you know, this is making me mildly uncomfortable. And the reason why for that is that I was thinking about higher education the other day. It might have been yesterday. And I know this is obvious once you say it, but what do they sell? They sell pieces of paper, right? Fancy pieces of paper that have been, you know, approved or become, what's that word? It starts with IM, like the stamp of approval.
Imprimatur.
Yeah. It gets, you know, pieces of paper that have an imprimatur from the school on it, right? And they're very expensive pieces of paper, but if that's what you sell, then coming up with more of those things is how you make money, not whether they actually create value. And the reason I was thinking about this is because there's been a huge rise in courses at places like Coursera or Udemy that are essentially trying to train you in certain specific skills, right? Like, oh, do you want to learn JavaScript? Here, take this class. And it might cost you $100 or it might cost you even less if you get like a subscription plan with some of these online courses. And you can walk away with skills that in theory you could then go get a job and start doing coding or something like that. And they're astronomically cheaper than, say, getting a degree at a university. It's just hard for me to see how the fiction of the university is going to continue for that long, given these much cheaper alternatives, which are accomplishing the same thing. They just don't have this fancy paper that they can give you.
Yeah, it is disconcerting. You know, I've heard recently some advertisements for, I think it's Vermont School of Law and Graduate Schools.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, yeah, if you don't want a JD, like, that's okay. You can still come to our school and still pay us for a really expensive degree.
Yeah.
And that's what this sounds like to me.
Yeah, 100%. Like, what are you going to use it for? Where's exactly. The practical?
Yeah. And anyway. We have a couple different news stories here. One from the newsroom.ggu.edu. So that's from Golden Gate's website. That's more of like a press release. And then there's a news story from Reuters. We can link to those in the show notes if you want to read up on this further. But that is what it sounds. You know, it's like all these grand claims about how they're going to continue the longstanding tradition and be at the forefront of this and that. We plan to build on areas of greatest potential in the legal profession, including interdisciplinary cross-university offerings. The work will complement what is happening in our business school, where we are developing high-demand programs for local, national, and international professionals seeking to advance their careers. All of this positions us to do what Golden Gate University does best: anticipate changing market needs, innovate with quality programs, and create opportunities for our students to advance their careers.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to talk about that from, 15 years on the other side of seeing Golden Gate sell JDs to students.
Yeah.
I mean, because for the last 15 years, that I've been in this business, Golden Gate has been there trying to recruit JD applicants, and they've always had like a super low LSAT median, and they've always had like a super low GPA median, and they've always had super low bar passage rates, and that's never stopped them from selling JDs.
Expensive as fuck JDs.
And I have advised people to go to Golden Gate on a scholarship. The people who could go to Golden Gate for free, if that was the best school you could get into for free, then okay, fine, go get your JD from Golden Gate. Who cares?
Yeah. Yeah.
But
your piece of paper. We should stop calling them degrees and just start calling them pieces of paper or lines on your resume.
Yeah. And this idea that, this is the chair of their board of trustees writing, saying, "For more than a century, that's been our hallmark, serving people who want a practical education, giving them the tools for successful careers and better lives." Yeah. For the last 15 years, I've seen Golden Gate admitting people who, based on their LSAT and their GPA, they just don't seem to have a very promising legal career ahead of them. And the market and the California bar have agreed. They've had for a long time, they've had problems getting their bar passage rates up. If you don't pass the bar, Ben, you cannot practice law.
Yeah, you have a piece of paper with a big red X on it.
And Golden Gate was perfectly happy to sell JDs to these people up until the point where it was clear that the American Bar Association was going to shut them down, or up to the point where it was clear that the market just wasn't there for them anymore.
Yeah, it's wild. But they had all these resources.
Happened, yeah.
So they don't want them to go to waste.
Yeah, and it's not like they're shutting down in shame. They're just like, pivoting to, oh yeah, no problem, we can just sell you some other fancy paper. It won't say JD on it, but it'll cost just as much, and we can admit the same people. And, it's kind of like, well, most of you weren't going to practice law anyway, so this will do just as good for you.
Yeah, and now we don't have the oversight of the ABA, which was nothing anyway. It was a toothless oversight, but it was something. It was somebody looking over their shoulder. Wow.
Not that we're shitting on Golden Gate in particular. It's just, you got to be really, really careful when you're in this market, because there are there's like sharks in these waters. And it's Golden Gate, and it's every school, you know, within 50 rankings points of them. Or yeah. I guess that they had fallen into the unranked category, huh? At some point. But it's like, you know, if you're looking at a school that's ranked, well, I don't know, you can't pick any number, right? But it's somewhere between 50 and 100, probably, is this dividing line. You know, and it's not like, and it isn't a dividing line. It's not a sharp dividing line. It's just that.
No, 99's great. They're, yeah, 99th is great. They're just perfect. Yeah, and 100 just, is criminal. But
yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, no, there is no magic number. So don't take it the wrong way. But like, there are schools that, where the vast majority of the people who go there are going to practice law. And then there, at some point, there's this transition where it is no longer true that even the majority of the people at that school are going to practice law.
Yeah. A sizable chunk can't, they don't pass the bar.
Right.
It's just not even an option to them. And then another sizable chunk, they can pass the bar, but they never get a job that pays anywhere close to what they even expected.
Right. Like they might, and some of them will have real legal careers. That's the thing, is that like, no, they do create real lawyers, especially, you know, the kids who were there on a scholarship,
especially
the ones that are there because they have the better LSAT, they have the better GPA. The school is like, well, you can come here for free because you're going to give us the veneer of legitimacy. Well, yeah, those students and some others who are there not on a scholarship, but get lucky, you know, some percentage of those students year after year after year were becoming public defenders and, you know, small firm lawyers and occasionally big law lawyers. But when 25%, like they've been struggling for years to reach 75% bar passage, which is the ABA's requirement.
Yeah.
And if more than a quarter of your class is not passing the bar, then, you know, of the ones who do pass the bar, you've got to think that there's going to be a pretty significant amount of attrition where they can't find any job in legal practice, or they only find a very miserable job in legal practice and wash out after a couple of years. And so, yeah, I just think that it's been true for a long time that this school and lots of schools like it were knowingly admitting year after year after year, admitting classes where it's like, dude, there's no way that half of these people are going to productively practice law. But you're charging them $65,000 a year times three.
Yep.
Which is like, I don't know.
Is that tuition at GGU?
I guessed. And that might have been overstating it. Let's see. Even more shocking, their acceptance rate last year was only 25.5%. Whoa. They got 1,046 applications. They offered 267 of those admission. They ended up enrolling 31 students.
What?
Yeah. So they admitted 267. So this is just the market saying no to Golden Gate. I mean, that's the thing that really, it's not even the ABA that actually shut them down, right? The ABA has been like warning them year after year after year, saying, hey, you know, you really got to get your bar passage rates up. You really got to get, this is, you're not in compliance. And it was this is what closed them down. I think it became clear because if you read the whole letter from Golden Gate, they had like declared they used financial exigency, which I had to look up exigency. It basically means emergency. Means emergency. And yeah, when you have 1,000 people apply to your school, you admit 267 of them, and only 11% of those 267 turn around and say, yes, I'll come to your school. And you end up admitting a class of only 31 people. Well, yeah, that is, the market has said no to you. the market is like, yeah, no, we're not going to your dumb
school. Interesting too, because they only accepted 267 of the 1,046 who applied. So who is applying? They just must be abysmal applicants, right?
They are abysmal applicants. I mean, of the ones that actually are at the school, you know, last year, so the 31 1Ls that they actually admitted had a 50th percentile LSAT of 154 and a 50th percentile UGPA of 3.26.
And that's full-time, yeah.
Oh, yep. Sorry, in the part-time program. Well, then, and this doesn't make sense. Like, I don't even trust these numbers anymore, right? Because now it's got 31 enrollees, but if you add up the total in the first year class.
Part-time and full-time. No, that's because there's 12 other first-year enrollees. I don't know how they were enrolled.
Oh, they're not enrollees from the applicant pool. Oh, I bet they've got some program, Ben.
Oh, my gosh. They're pulling people from their undergrad. They're like, thanks for all the money you gave us in undergrad. Now, please give us. Oh, my gosh.
Yep. Like, if you know, because you came through our program, so then you don't even need to apply through our. You can save it's so much easier. You don't even need to, you know, don't worry about it. You don't have to take the LSAT. We'll just admit you right into the JD program. Anyway, when you're looking at a 154 and a 3.26 as your median, you're just looking at people that don't look equipped to go into this gladiator industry. It's no surprise that the job outcomes have been not there, and the bar passage rate has been not there. And finally, when the market said, yeah, we really just don't want this product, then that's when they decided to bow out. Don't know what more to say about that.
Yeah, that's crazy. Okay. Goodbye, GGU.
Farewell. Yeah. I don't know what to say, except for I think there should be a lot more of these. I mean, yep. I just based on my experience in this business, law schools are far too happy to admit too many and underqualified applicants. And you just see year after year after year, you see crowds of these poor kids going in and paying a lot of money. They're just getting sold a dream, which is really tragic.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate that.
Yeah. All right. Well, this on to other things, I guess, yeah. LSAT related. This next email is from Anonymous. The subject is help with RC. I'll go ahead and read it. Hi, Ben and Nathan. I always score perfectly on logic games and usually score 0 to 3 wrong on logical reasoning. In reading comprehension, my scores really vary. I can get anywhere from 1 to 6 wrong, but typically score 3 to 4 wrong. I often find myself crossing out every answer choice. I do best on science passages and ones that are more philosophical or abstract.
Stop thinking about that.
Yeah, the topic doesn't matter. For question types, inference and structure questions are the hardest. Okay, well, that's pretty much all the questions.
I mean, they're just all a bunch of must be true questions.
Yeah, which is an inference question. So you're looking at the vast majority of questions in reading comprehension. I'm an overthinker, and when I read an explanation, I realize what I'm looking for is more simple than I thought. So far, I've tried slowing down while reading the passage, doing lots of reading comp sections untimed, and treating it like logical reasoning. However, even if I do a section untimed, I can still get up to 6 or more wrong! Any advice? Feeling stuck?
Yes, I have advice. Students need to stop thinking about question types on reading comprehension. It's not helping you. You know, going in, that most of the questions are just asking you, what did it say? And you need to have your must be true hat on when you're doing reading comp. So if you're good at logical reasoning, then that means you're good at must be trues, because there are explicitly must be true questions on logical reasoning. There's explicitly must be true questions on logic games as well. On reading comprehension, students don't understand what they're being asked. They think they're being asked to think they think they're being asked to like do some analysis that they're not really being asked to do. All they're being asked to do is, hey, what was the main point? What did the author want? What did the author say about this thing? What did the author say about that thing? Or they might ask you questions like, what did the author say these critics said about this other thing? But I really think that you should just think about reading comp as 27 must be true questions in a row, except for maybe there might be one strengthen or weaken question that they mix in that 27 question section, one or two. And you'll see it when you come across it, because it's going to say which one of the following, if true, would support the case that's being made in this part of the passage or something like that. It'll say, hey, we're going to help it or we're going to hurt it. That's your one strengthen or weaken question per section. But usually it's 26 out of 27 or sometimes 27 out of 27 questions in the section that are just asking you really to say what the passage said. So when this correspondent thinks that they are overthinking, I think what you're doing is you're just not understanding that all they're really ever asking you is, did you get the main point? Did you get what the author said about this part? Did you get what the author said about that part? And they want you to pick answers that are firmly rooted in the evidence. So think about, you know, this idea that you're doing a section untimed and still missing more than six questions. That to me means that you just don't understand what you're being asked. And what they're really asking you is just what is in the passage. Pick answers that are supported by specific text in the passage.
Yeah, another way of looking at this and just saying exactly what you're already saying, but in a different way, the passage is composed of 15, 16 sentences. There are 5 to 8 questions for every reading comp passage. Those 5 to 8 questions are asking you about individual sentences in that passage. They're just saying, what was said? They don't tell you exactly which sentence to go find the answer in, obviously, but you can back up the correct answer with 1 or 2, maybe 3, but usually 1 or 2 of the sentences from the passage will prove that answer choice. So do you know the record? Can you find evidence in the record to justify the answer choice? If you can't, then don't pick an answer and keep working on trying to understand the passage.
Yeah. We've talked about this before. I still think that we do students a bit of a disservice by showing them question types in the DMIN for reading comprehension. That's something that we've always done. It's kind of a legacy thing. And I will, I think, continue advocating for us to just get rid of those. I think it's semantics that don't really help people. When this correspondent says inference and structure questions are the hardest, I don't even notice those question types at all. When I read the question, all it ever seems to be asking to me is, what did it say about this? What did it say about that? It always asks me, what was the main point? It always asks me, what was the primary purpose? Which to me is the same thing, because their purpose is to prove their main point. Many of the questions that appear to be more detailed questions, the correct answer turns out to just be basically the main point of the passage. And it's like, I just think that if I was able to teach reading comp, and this is how I teach reading comp. I mean, in my classes, I totally ignore all question type stuff. It's like when people start talking about various different reading comp question types, I'm just like, hey, I don't even see that. I just see them asking me over and over, what did it say? What did it say? What did it say? And what must be true? Where's the receipts? Show me the receipts in the passage that's justifying this answer. And I think that should help Anonymous.
I definitely agree with that. And I do think that part of the problem stems from people. Well, so many questions are just straight up, which one of the following is supported or proven by the passage? And when the test writers say, which one of the following is something that, you know, an inference, they use that word literally.
Oh, yeah.
that's especially where people start reading too much into the question. Well, even if we've tagged that as a must be true question.
No, the famous one is like, it can be inferred from the passage that the author would be most likely to agree with which one of the following. Mm-hmm. And they can even do it with, it can be inferred from the passage that the critics of so-and-so would believe which one of the following.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it really makes people start thinking like, ooh, inference, or ooh, I have to figure out which one they would be likely to agree with.
Yeah. And also the word from too, right? Like, oh, from the passage.
Inferred
like
from the passage.
Like I'm taking the passage and I'm going somewhere with it. And
right.
I think technically that's true because the correct answer isn't a verbatim quote from the passage usually.
Right.
But the distance that the answer goes from the passage is so microscopic that it's not what people are expecting in some cases, especially when they're new.
Yeah. And the most important part of that question stem is the words from the passage.
Mm-hmm.
The passage.
Yeah.
It says in the passage.
Yeah.
Because they're not asking you to infer shit from your brain, like from your outside information, or from they're not asking you to like make things up. They're not asking you to think about what the author might say next. They're testing you on your reading comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to know whether you understood what it said in the passage. So when they say which one of the, it can be inferred from the passage that the author would agree with which one of the following, I think you can just immediately go, which one must be true? Which one did it say in the passage?
Yeah. Or if you need that clarification that they're specifically asking about the author's viewpoint as opposed to somebody else's viewpoint, although you should have that clear in your mind, you could rephrase the question as simply, what did the passage say the author thinks on this point? Like what answer? Yeah, what answer was said in the passage regarding the author's view on this issue?
And even before you get to the answers, when you read the question,
mm-hmm.
it can be inferred from the passage that the author would believe which one of the following about XYZ. Okay, well, what did the passage say about XYZ? What did the author say about XYZ? Oh, mm-hmm. they said that it was a good idea in theory, but a bad idea in practice. Okay, now I'm going to go into the answers looking yeah. for good idea in theory, bad idea in practice. I'm probably not going to find those exact words, but I'm going to find something that means something a lot like that because mm-hmm. that's what it said in the passage about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's the value of predicting answers instead of just diving right into the answer choices, hoping that the answers are going to bail you out. They're testing you on your reading comprehension. They're asking you questions that are answerable based on the passage. You should be predicting an answer whenever you can. And if that means you have to go back to the passage to try to like review what the author said about this part of the topic, then you should. You should go back. You should refresh yourself. Then start messing with those answers, because otherwise you're just going to get caught up in answer choices that sound attractive because it's got a lot of the right words, but then it's got some idea in it that is just not the idea that was actually in the passage, and you're going to miss that question every time. I want to point out here that there is also a lot on the LSAT, and this bleeds over from the reading comprehension into the logical reasoning. They're testing your reading comprehension always, and one way that they love to do that is by making their questions really convoluted to try to figure out whose perspective they're actually talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I ran across yesterday in my double black diamond logical reasoning class, that's my expert level LR class, I ran into a question where it was talking about, it said something like the position attacked by the critics of anti-environmentalism or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, the position attacked by the critics of anti-environment. That's not exactly what it was, but it was something.
I know what you're talking about. And you got to work backwards, right? You got to say, okay, so you got critics of anti-environmentalism. Okay, well, let's start with anti-environmentalism. So you're against the environment, and then you have critics who are going against that. So they must be in favor of the environment. And then they're, okay,
the position
so now,
attacked by those people.
Yeah, so it must be the... the anti-environmentalist position right. that's being attacked. Yeah, you really got to work backwards. And as long as you orient yourself along the way, then you can totally understand it. And you've just unlocked that passage. And that's probably all the question is about. You unlocked it and bam, now you're done.
Exactly. That turns out to be the whole point of the question. Mm-hmm. And students miss it because students like to focus on one word. You know, students are like, well, it asked me what the critics thought.
And I saw the word anti-environmentalism. So this is a thing against the environment. It's like, are you sure?
Right. Yeah. And no, you really have to unwrap it to figure out who they're actually talking about. Mm-hmm. And they do this on purpose because it's a reading comprehension test.
Yeah.
Like they're trying to make a test that gives a bell curve of outcomes. They don't want everybody to score perfectly on it. They want you to miss. I mean, they want people to miss some questions.
Yeah.
But it nonetheless, the answer is 100% correct. Like it is logically valid. It's correct. And, you know, if you got 100 expert LSAT people, they would all answer the same, that you can figure it out. But you do have to take the time to figure it out. Because, yeah, they're asking you, they're giving you convoluted phrases and sentences and paragraphs and questions and answer choices. They're giving it to you in a messy, convoluted way because they're like, okay, are you going to be able to cut it in legal practice when you're trying to sort through a 40-page contract or whatever it is with all these loop clauses and circular whatever and it, like... You just have to take the time to figure out what it says.
Well, I mean, that's how the world of law works, right?
Yeah.
Legislation is written down in the English language.
Yeah.
Court decisions are written down in the English language. And contracts are written in the English language. Like, people write shit down, and then they expect certain behaviors to result from that written text. So if you can't read exactly what was said and understand exactly the meaning... then you're going to get beat by others who can. Right? They're going to be like, "No, Your Honor, it says this." And then the judge is going to say, "You're right. It says that. Why is this other person arguing such a foolish position?"
Yeah. And at every level, at half of your mistakes or more are going to be from simply just misreading stuff. When you're preparing for the LSAT, I talked to 135 scorers and I talked to 175 scorers. And when we look at the mistakes that 135 scorers are making, there's a heavy dose of, you didn't quite understand what you read.
Yeah.
And when I look at the mistakes that are made by 175 scorers, there's a heavy dose of, you just didn't understand what you read.
Yep. Just on a fewer number of questions.
Right.
or less questions. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Cool. I hope we helped Anonymous. Should we keep it moving?
Yeah. So we got a couple emails from listeners who weren't happy with their scores on the November LSAT. You want to take this first one from Anonymous?
Hi, Ben and Nathan. In prepping for the November test, I was scoring in the upper part of my range, around 176. Day of my November test, I found out a family member had passed an hour before the exam and then had some technical issues during the test. I was so upset from all of this, I wasn't even able to finish the last two questions of logic games, which I always score perfectly on, usually with a minute to spare. I even had to guess the last five questions on reading comp. I scored 167 on the November test, so 9 points lower than where Anonymous was scoring on their practice tests. Any advice on how to prepare to do well on the January test, even with these test day issues? Reading comprehension is my weakness, with usually 1 to 5 questions wrong. Thank you.
Well, first of all, Anonymous, you're already ready to score very well on test day. presumably, hopefully, no other family members pass away before that exam. So that should, in theory, be taken care of. The next issue is technical issues, which you've already experienced. So now you can imagine, okay, what's going to happen if I have technical issues? How should I deal with those if they do happen? They probably won't, but if they do, how will I deal with them? And that's going to help you have a better mindset and do better on the actual test day. I think you're going to continue practicing and reviewing. I mean, geez, you're already scoring in the high 170s on your practice test. That means you know how to study and how to review. Just keep doing that. I think you're going to do well in January. And if you don't, you can take it again.
Yeah, I would say run it back. I think you're not as good at logic games as you think you are. You know, you didn't finish this time, but you say you always score perfectly, usually even with a minute to spare.
You're hoping for more time.
Well, for somebody who is actually reliably scoring perfectly on the games, I think that that means that you're sometimes finishing in 30 minutes or sure. You're sometimes finishing in 28 minutes or 25 minutes.
Certainly not required. And you don't need to do that. You don't need to rush to get there. But occasionally that should land in your lap because the four games were just easy as fuck.
Well, yes, because there are ways to make them easy. And it sounds like maybe Anonymous is doing a little brute force sometimes, like just kind of like, you know, squeaking through the section instead of really destroying the section. So I wonder, Anonymous, you know, how good are you at making worlds? Is that a key part of your approach? And do you frequently do an entire game in 4 minutes? Because you should. If you really are good at the games, then you're going to sometimes do games in 4 or 5 minutes. In fact, something like half of the games you're probably going to do in like 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah. So then you're finishing the first two games in 8 to 10 minutes, which means you now have 25 minutes to do two games, which should be more than enough on a lot of tests. Not always. Some tests have wonky games are a little harder.
And not to say that's going to happen all the time.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it's like, look, that's great that you've gotten to the point where you feel really confident about the games, but you can continue to get better. And I would think that Worlds is the place to go there. But my main advice to Anonymous would just be run it back. Dude, you've got 176s as you're usually scoring in the mid 170s. Fantastic. Shit happens on the day of the test and you had a family member pass away. Go take it again. You're good. I think this is somebody who I hope they're signed up for January already. They should sign up for February. They should also plan on taking April and June if necessary. And then hopefully they're done.
Yeah, because you're going to have a random set of scores. You might get a 170, but you should definitely take it again. You might get a 175 and still decide to take it again. Just be ready to take it multiple times so you can really get the best score you're capable of.
Yeah. And if I had only had one LSAT tip to give, that would be on the short list. I'm not gonna say that this is the one that I would save if I could only save one, you know, run back into the burning house and only take one LSAT tip.
We shall put it in the vault in
But
yeah.
When you're happy with your practice test scores, which Anonymous is, you should just plan on taking the test as many times as necessary in order to replicate that score. And it's just plan on, it's not going to happen on your first or second or next attempt.
Yeah.
It's going to happen eventually if you just keep taking official tests. Keep treating them the same way you've been treating all your practice test scores. Your first official test is a practice test for your second official test is a practice test for your third official test. And eventually you're going to get a score that that reflects what your practice test record reflects. And sometimes people use up all 5 of their attempts. And we've sent people to Harvard Law School and Yale Law School who have taken it 5 times.
Yep. But no stigma there.
No, no shame in that at all. Want to read this one from Paige?
Yep. Paige just scored 150 on the November LSAT, despite recent practice test scores ranging from 157 to 161. I feel defeated, frustrated, and honestly don't know what to do / where to go from here. I have some test day anxiety, but it would affect my score by nearly 10 points? I would love to hear any tips you may have for me going forward, such as studying tips or testing day tips. Thank you, Paige.
You gotta get happy enough, Paige, with your practice test scores that you are going to be comfortable treating the official test like it's just another practice test. I don't know how we get there. But students who collapse on test day due to test day anxiety, you're not treating the official test like a practice test.
Yeah, and like you were just talking about, you're probably, these are students, Paige, maybe you fall into this camp where you're like, nope, one and done. I can do this. This is my test. I'm going to nail it. Then I'm going to apply. I don't have that much time anyway.
It's the most well-meaning, totally misguided idea that we see. And we see it all the fucking time. And we see, unfortunately, some of our colleagues in the pre-law advisor community tell students this, they give students this kind of an idea, right? Yeah. They say dumb shit like, well, you know, law schools, they do consider all of your scores. So it's really best if you just only take it once or maybe twice.
Yeah. So then it adds a little pressure.
Which is like, really? So Yale Law School, which admits people who take it five times, and Harvard Law School, which admits people who take it five times, and all these other schools that I can name where I've sent people there who got a full ride scholarship, who took it five times.
Yep.
But all those instances, though, like they were getting in despite the fact that they took it five times. They were getting a full ride scholarship despite the fact that they took it five times. No, that's not how it works. No, law schools just don't care.
Because they took it five times and got a fucking amazing score.
Right.
So
yeah. And it's always better to take it again if you didn't score what you could have scored. And Paige knows that she's capable of scoring better based on her practice test scores. So yeah, Paige, you got to go back and take it again. One note for Paige, because Paige's practice test scores are a little lower, or actually significantly lower than Anonymous immediately preceding her. I have a feeling that Paige maybe isn't happy with that 157 to 161 range.
Mm.
Like Paige, you know, I'm not sure, I'm making this up, but one cause of this could be I'm scoring 157 to 161, but man, I really am hoping for a 165.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take the test trying to get a 165.
Yep. Yep.
And did you do that, Paige? Did you maybe go a little bit faster than you normally do? Or did you maybe go a little bit slower than you normally do because you were trying to triple check everything because you really didn't want to make any mistakes? So you slowed way down. I have a feeling Paige sped up a little bit, or she slowed down a little bit / a lot because she was reaching for a 165 that wasn't actually in her range.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you do get a score that's outside your range.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when you get a score that's outside your range, it's far more likely to be way below your range than it is to be some amazing one-off luck out.
Yeah.
There's lots of ways to fuck it up. It's really hard to luck out.
Great. Good luck, Paige. Keep us posted. Keep going. Increase your practice test scores too if you can. Shane.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like Paige. Roll into this next practice test with a range of 165 to 168, you know, and feel so much more confident. Like, well, yeah, I know I can get a 165 because I've got plenty of those in my practice test record, and I've even got better than that. And now go take the official test, just hoping to replicate something within your range. People have to stop trying to shoot for the top of their range. It's like me going out to the golf course expecting to shoot my best score every time. If those are your expectations, it's just, It's going to be a disaster. Ben, what if you went in expecting to have like your best workout every single time or your best run every time?
Yeah. And then when you, yeah, it's funny because what happens is, right, you're trying to get 12 reps or whatever, and it, you know, you're like shaking on rep 10. So then what do? You cheat. You do a cheat rep. And that's fine. Maybe you can get to 12 reps, but what's going to happen on the actual test? You're not going to get points for those reps.
The cheat ones. Yeah.
Yeah. You could even hurt yourself.
Yeah.
So, yep. Don't do it.
All right. What's up with Shane? Oh, Shane says, hi, I took the last two LSATs and have scored a 161 and a 162 respectively. I'm not taking it again due to financial reasons.
That's tough. Because there are other financial reasons to consider here, like the cost of law school.
Much bigger, much more important financial reasons, Shane. I feel like that's just a tragic error. I understand that it's $215. I hope you have applied for the LSAC fee waiver. If you haven't already, LSAC gives out free LSATs. Maybe Shane already did get the LSAC fee waiver, and those are the two free LSATs via the fee waiver. But if you haven't, you should get it. If you've already used it up, I think you should save up some money and take the test again. But anyway, Shane continues, I'm not taking it again due to financial reasons. I'm hoping to finish with a 3.9 plus UGPA. My goal is to go to law school for free, and I don't care about rankings. I have a couple questions about the scholarship estimator. One, can more than half sometimes mean full on the estimator? I think the answer to that is no.
Well, it's no, because if it's more than half, then that's what the data suggested before. Of course, people can have that estimate and end up getting a full tuition scholarship.
Oh, yeah.
Because the estimator isn't perfect. But
these are just estimates. But what the estimator is doing, and again, this is lsatdemon.com/scholarships. All the estimator is doing is spitting out, here's what happened last year based on American Bar Association data.
With someone who had similar numbers as you.
Right. So, and on the 509s, when we look at that 509 data, it divides it up. And we've, you know, 5 years ago, I remember us like laughing about this on the show, that they do have this category of more than half, but then they have another category for full and a separate category for more than full. And they show percentages that add up to 100% in all those categories. So if the percentages add up to 100%, then more than full cannot also mean full because they have a separate category for full. So the projection is more than full, not including half. Oh, sorry. More than half, not including full.
Yep. Yep.
But you can get an actual offer that's way above that or way below that because all we're doing is projecting based on last year's data. Number two from Shane, why isn't he projected for a full tuition scholarship at some schools where he's above the 75th percentiles for both LSAT and GPA?
That just depends on the school. Right. Again, we're looking at the past data. So some schools don't give out that many full tuition scholarships.
Right. There's going to be some schools that don't give out any full tuition scholarships. And the thing you got to do, Shane, is you got to click into the 509 reports. We have a little PDF logo there out to the right next to every school on the estimator. And if you click that PDF icon and scroll down to the, usually it's on the bottom of the second page or the top of the third page of the 509. They really try to hide it from you, where you find that scholarship matrix. And if you dig into that scholarship matrix, my hypothesis is going to be that if you're above their 75th on both LSAT and GPA, and it says no scholarship or doesn't, it says you don't get a full ride, then my guess is that that school just doesn't give full rides. So look at the 509 to confirm that.
Okay. This next one is from Donald. The subject is law school scholarship estimator with extensive work history. Greetings, Ben and Nathan. I'm a tenured associate professor of educational leadership going up for full professor this fall. I am also currently serving as an associate dean. I have published over 30 peer-reviewed manuscripts authored books and book chapters, and presented countless presentations at academic conferences. Okay, a true academic. I'm currently studying for the LSAT using your resources and hoping to score at least a 170. Here's the kicker. My UGPA, my undergraduate GPA, is terrible, 3.02. I hope to stay within my state and attend Georgia State University in their part-time program, and I would have to score at least a 166 to receive any scholarship discount per the estimator. My UGPA does not reflect my ability. As I maintained a 4.0 throughout my post-bachelor degrees, including my PhD, work at an R1 flagship university. So considering my academic and professional background, does any of this matter when awarding full scholarships? Or should I expect the worst if I score within their LSAT 50th percentile?
Georgia State is the school we're talking about?
Yep.
161... 50th percentile LSAT, 162, 75th percentile LSAT. My hypothesis would be that this school is not even going to be very impressed by a 170. I think that this school probably treats a 165 and a 170 as almost the same thing. I mean, significantly above their median one way or the other. Does it really matter that much to them at that point? I don't think so, because it raises their median no matter what.
Yep.
Which is to say that I'm feeling like Georgia State might not be a very good fit for this person if they're fishing for a scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because their median GPA is 3.6. You're way below their median GPA. You're also way below their 25th percentile GPA. Not that that matters so much. I mean, you're going to be in the bottom quartile of the class on GPA, and you're going to be in the top quartile on LSAT. Unfortunately, you're like too far into that top quartile. All I'm saying is that it seems like wasted. It's like kind of like wasted capacity.
Yeah, the extra points aren't doing that much for you. Granted, they are going to increase your index number at Georgia State University, which is probably why it's helpful for them. But I do think your academic background is going to be appealing to them. It's a soft factor, so it's not going to be a game changer. At the same time, I think they're going to look at your application and say, okay, well, this person knows how to do school now, so that's good.
Looking at the grants and scholarships table for 2021-2022 for Georgia State, looking at the actual 509, mm-hmm. This school is not like a notorious scholarship grantor. They grant 49% total, 49% total. 59% of the full-time program, only 18% of the part-time program are getting some kind of a scholarship. But of those scholarships, 24% of the class getting less than half tuition, 2% getting half to full, and, well, 23% getting full tuition, which is not nothing.
Yeah, that's big for full.
But I think that this school would, I think that if you were applying with a 162 and a 3.7, like just above their median on both LSAT and GPA, I think that that's a lot better candidate for a scholarship than applying with as a splitter, you know, with a real high LSAT and a real low GPA and all this academic background. I don't think that academic background is going to influence their scholarship decision.
Yeah. Well,
like, why would it?
It doesn't.
How does that benefit them?
It doesn't. But I do think, what am I thinking here? Okay. So if they're going to admit any splitters and give them scholarships, Donald would be among that group, because they would say, okay, Donald's a splitter, but you're kind of a diamond in the rough, because we don't think your 3.02 really reflects what you can do now here at Georgia State University.
Yes, but I could also, like, how does this even make sense? Why is Donald applying to law school? Donald's up for full professorship. Donald is a tenured associate professor of educational leadership. going up for full professor, are you trying to go to law school to become a law professor? Is that the idea?
Yeah, good question.
I mean, the vast majority of law professors come from top 14 schools, though. So, like, going to Georgia State trying to be a law professor seems like a bad plan. I mean, Donald very likely knows shit that we don't know and has a... If you have some, like, career track in academia that involves a JD and you've already got that lined up, then don't let me, you know, just make shit up here. But to me, I don't know that... I'm trying to figure out how this makes sense. It sounds like a career change to me. Yeah, I guess we just don't know.
Yeah. Apply elsewhere, Donald, if you're willing.
Well, for sure. Like, you need to apply broadly. Oh, shit. Also, Donald does want to attend the part-time program.
Which has even fewer scholarships, right?
Yeah, so. I should have given you the part-time numbers. I'm sorry I missed that. But no, I mean, Donald, the part-time program at this school, 30% get grants, but 17% is less than half tuition. You got 9% getting half to full and 4% getting full. So it's way, way harder to get good scholarships in their part-time program than it is to get good scholarships in their full-time program. I just don't see it. I don't see a splitter getting a full ride at the school, but in the part-time program. But you'll never know until you apply. So apply broadly, see what kind of offers you get. Just make sure you're willing to walk away from any bad offers.
Great. Next one's from Zach. The question is, subject, can a low LSAT score ever hurt your future application?
Hello, Ben and Nathan. I recently took the November LSAT and scored a disgusting 136. Needless to say, immediately afterward, I bought a subscription to The Demon and am planning to use the platform until I hit my goal. I know you have made episodes in the past about why you should never cancel a score because schools only look at your highest score. However, given that my score is so horrendous and shows I absolutely had no understanding of the test, do you think such a low score would hurt my application in the future?
Okay, I don't think you need to worry about this score. At the same time, that score is not going to do anything for you. You're not going to get into any school that is worth attending or at a scholarship amount that's going to matter with that score. So I would prefer to cancel it. Like, just don't even show them that low number.
A 136 and a zero are very similar. That said, if you haven't already canceled it, I don't give a shit. I don't care if it's on your record or not. I mean, what's going to matter is, Zach, what's going to matter is what score you get eventually. Mm-hmm. Your high score is the one that's going to count. So yep. Yeah, if you bought Score Preview and if you do still have the chance to cancel this score, right, 136 is a score that gets you into zero law schools ever, so you can safely just cancel it. But having a cancel and then an eventual 165 or whatever it is, you know, does the record really look different if it shows cancel 165 or if it shows 136, 165? Is there really a difference there? I don't think so. In both cases, the 165 is what goes into their index calculation.
Yeah.
In both cases, the 165 is what gets reported to the American Bar Association if they decide to admit you, or if you matriculate there after they've decided to admit you. So I just think it doesn't matter. Zach, I don't think it's a thing you can control. If you can cancel it, fine, cancel it. But if you can't cancel it, who cares? Because what really matters is where you go from here.
Great. The next one is from Alexander. The subject is 140 to 173 and whether to stop now or keep going.
33-point improvement and thinking about getting greedier. I love it. Yeah. I've been innate. I started my LSAT journey with a 140 cold diagnostic in January 2022 and in November of 2023. I scored a 173 on my first official test. Wow.
Seriously?
Wow. Bravo. So, yeah, I mean, that's almost 2 years of studying. Well, we don't know that Alexander kept studying after that cold diagnostic, but 2 years between cold diagnostic and 173 first official test.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Alexander says, I'm super grateful to both of you and Allah and the demon team for the instrumental guidance that you provided, which made that progress possible. At this point, I'm leaning toward concluding my LSAT journey, but I'm curious whether you guys think it would be a mistake. I know generally that you both recommend that students retake because it's low risk, high reward, but based on my last 10 practice tests, there's only a 20% chance I would score higher on my next official take, and even then, only by 1 or 2 points. Given that, and given that I do feel ready to move on with my life, do you think moving on from the LSAT at this point would be reasonable? Thank you in advance. P.S. Last 10 practice tests, most recent, most to least recent. Wait, what? Oh, so most recent first.
Yep.
I'm going to read it the other way around.
Okay.
Oldest first. 170, 170, 168, 173, 171, 166, 161, 174, 171, 175. So 2 out of the last 3 are higher?
Yeah. In the last 5, you do have a 161 and a 166.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't know the dates of those, and we don't know anything about what happened on those. But I just would point out that, you know, depending on where you draw the reference frame, right? Like Alexander is saying there's only a 20% chance. Well, based on your last 10.
Yep.
But there appears to be a 66% chance based on your last 3.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, the 161 in there is kind of a stinker that happened pretty recently. I just don't think it would hurt you though. Even if you did get a low score like that and put it on your record, you're still a 173 in the eyes of the schools.
Yeah. And notice what, Alexander says for his GPA.
P.S. My credential assembly service, UGPA, is a 3.98.
Which means, Alexander, that you have the opportunity to apply to the best schools in the world. And 1 or 2 points at those schools makes a big difference.
Yeah, it depends, Alexander, how much you want to go to Harvard, Stanford, Yale. If you want those schools to be reasonably in your range, I think you got to take it again.
Even if not, right? Like, that's going to matter for schools that are just ranked below that, that would then be willing to give you scholarships, full tuition.
A lot of money. A lot of money. Yeah. That said, if you decide to apply with this, I'm not going to be mad about it.
It's an excellent score. And you've made a lot of progress. Just don't let the starting point become an excuse to it. It's like, what if you had started with a 169? Would you be happy? Yet your starting point is irrelevant in a lot of ways. Something to think about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. Your relevant starting point is a 173 because that's what you've currently got on record.
Yeah.
Can you score higher than that? Your practice test record indicates that you can score higher than that. You've scored higher than that on 2 out of your last 3 exams. Well, 2 out of your last 4, counting the official, I guess.
It's December, so assuming you're not applying this cycle, but next cycle, you have lots of time.
Yeah, tragically, I fear that Alexander is applying this cycle. But because that's with, you know, the I am leaning, I'm ready to move on with my life, that type of thing.
Yep.
Makes me think that Alexander might be trying to apply right now. Lots of people trying to apply right now. There would be nothing wrong, Alexander, with deciding to wait until next fall to apply, take the LSAT 1 or 2 more times, possibly get a 175 or 176, possibly apply to Yale. But, you know, that's your decision. Ultimately, how much of a master of the universe do you want to be? And you're 175 and you're 173 and a 3.98. And, you know, you might be like, no, I live in Washington State, for example, and I want to stay in Washington State. I want to go to the University of Washington. It's the best school in my state by far. 173 and 3.98 is a shoe-in at University of Washington Law School, I think. And you might decide that you're going to apply to that school and a bunch of other competing schools so that you can get a wide range of offers and be perfectly happy with this. But if you, if you're looking to shoot a shot at the top of the top 14, then I think you probably want to consider at least taking it again.
Cool. Thanks for writing in and good luck. This week's shout out comes from LSAT Demon student Kayla, who's just scored a 169 on the November LSAT. That's up from a diagnostic in the low 140s. Kayla writes, thank you to the LSAT Demon, especially Beth. Beth played a huge role in helping me to iron out foundational gaps and increase my confidence. Producer Eric notes that Beth teaches LR, one easy, one hard, on Saturdays and Sundays. You can listen to her on her own LSAT success story on LSAT Demon Daily episode 321.
Yeah, Beth's killing it. That class is a early morning Saturday, Sunday class. So far, the attendance has been pretty low, I think just because, you know, there's not that many rise and grinders on a Saturday and Sunday morning, but there should be. It's a great class. It's only 30 minutes. She does one easier LR question and then one harder LR question. And go say hi to Beth and do a couple LR questions on a Saturday or Sunday morning. If you can't go Saturday, Sunday morning, you can always watch the recordings because they're posted shortly after class. But great job, Beth. And thank you to Kayla for writing in.
Yeah. And congrats on the 169. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's another, boy, diagnostic in the low 140s. Just scored 169 on the official November LSAT. So you're looking at a 25-point improvement at least. Fantastic. Good job, Kayla.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at Thinking LSAT. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 432 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.